cliffcentral.com. So today on the Burning Platform, which is brought to you every week by Nando's, we discuss some current affairs. We talk a little bit about the politics and the economics and the social goings-on in South Africa. And this morning we're joined by our returning champion, Canton Pillay, who's ready to address all the questions and all the big issues. And along with him, Gabriel Krauser, who's from the Institute of Race Relations, but who looks increasingly like Jesus with his big beard. No. You look like Jesus.
Abraham.
No, Jesus. Trust me. How do you know what Abraham looked like? At least we've got some representation.
No, I don't know.
Big Jesus beard. You've got the whole thing going on. All right. So
a lockdown beard indeed.
Yeah, welcome, Gabriel.
I just want to point out, guys.
Thank you so much.
We are doing the normal hair thing this morning.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it means that, you know, in terms of clicks adverts, this is what I consider to be normal hair.
I know. We were talking about this earlier, and I actually said to Sia, I got in the shower this morning, and I didn't even think about it. And I looked at the shampoo that I've got, and guess what it is? It's Tresemme dry and damaged hair.
Well, yeah, there you go.
Too. Yeah. So now I know I can't buy it at Clicks or at Checkers by the looks of things. But
yes, but thank goodness for online shopping, right, guys?
Yeah, yeah. So I think we could still buy it there. Anyway, I mean, eventually, where are the EFF going to protest when we're all online shopping? Where are they eventually going to go? They'll have to protest in their own houses online.
Well, it's not their own houses. They get it from tobacco barons, don't they?
Oh, that's true. They get those paid for by someone else. Correct. There's nothing like someone who doesn't have any of their own money complaining about people who do and then trying to get those who have less money than them out of their jobs. Anyway, we'll get onto that in a second. There's so much to talk about this week. First things first, Canton, what's going on with you? Any updates? Anything that you want us to know about that you're busy with at the moment? Reading anything interesting? You know, people are interested in this stuff.
I actually finally got down to finishing Mo Sheikh's book. You might remember that.
Yes, we had him on the show.
We had him on the show quite a while back. And I'd started reading it during the stage one of lockdown when, you know, we were all held at gunpoint in our homes. And I went through a significant chunk of it at the time, but I finally got down to finishing it just a couple of days ago.
Uh-huh.
And I must say that I came out of it actually feeling – surprisingly charitable towards Mo Sheikh in terms of the entire debacle that went down with Jacob Zuma. And he writes quite candidly about it, that, you know, essentially Jacob Zuma was a person that he and a lot of other people would have been, you know, willing to take bullets for literally during the apartheid years. And effectively, Jacob Zuma stabbed them in the back.
Yeah, well, he did that to a lot of people.
Yeah, fascinating, and he did it for the benefit of the Guptas. I mean, who would have actually thought?
Yeah, especially when he had such a relationship with the whole Sheikh family going back such a long way. You know, there's Yunus and there's Mo and there's Shabir, and we know how Shabir Sheikh has had to take the hit for Jacob Zuma, and obviously he didn't take as much of a hit as he might have. In a normal criminal justice system. But, you know, he's become almost a joke. And I remember in the conversation that we had with Mo, he addressed the issue of Shabir. But in the book, he goes into some detail around all the actual skullduggery that happened. I mean, he was the chief of intelligence at the time.
Yes, indeed.
So he had some pretty interesting insights.
But pretty much what happened was that Siyabonga Qwele, who was the minister at the time, systematically undermined Mo's efforts to put in place essentially a professional intelligence organization that was ultimately responsible for providing credible information through to the president, rather than an intelligence organization that was essentially gone rogue and trying to carry out an agenda on the part of the president.
Now, Gabriel, you obviously are a writer. You're an analyst at the Institute of Race Relations. You published some really interesting things recently. You obviously base a lot of it on field work, quantitative analysis. Land reform is something you've been talking about quite a lot. But you've also got a degree in philosophy from Princeton University. I'm interested in that because I hate to start with this, but we've got to explode some heads this morning. Donald Trump has just been nominated by one person anyway for the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize. What would the people at Princeton do if you could imagine what they must be feeling this morning? Are Princeton University going to be happy about the fact that Donald J. Trump has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize?
I doubt it. I will say that of the Ivy Leagues, Princeton is probably the most centrist, or of the most centrist.
Okay.
So, you know, I had two of my econ professors were Republican White House advisors. And actually, one of my professors nominated a Chinese man whose name I can't remember right now for the Nobel Peace Prize, and he won. Oh. He was under house arrest at the time. So I don't think he was able to collect it in person. But definitely, yeah, I mean, I will say, for example, at Princeton, a lot of my fellow students and professors were quite skeptical about Obama winning the Peace Prize. I think that was really premature.
Even Obama was skeptical about winning the Peace Prize. You remember when he accepted it, it was one of the most awkward speeches he's given, and he's a very erudite man. But he was going, well, thank you very much for this. I'm not sure what I got it for.
Yeah, which I think is
especially spot on. Since he was about to start bombing Yemen and taking out Libya and all of that fun stuff.
Yeah,
I think and drone warfare across the world to an unprecedented degree. But we'll leave it alone for the moment. So the reason
we just need to understand the process.
Yeah,
guys, we just need to understand the process that practically anyone can nominate anyone else for the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's correct.
So I can nominate Sia for the Nobel Peace Prize, and you know, frankly, I think he's far more qualified to get the Nobel Peace Prize than most of the nominees that end up on that shortlist.
Who should get it is a whole other discussion. But I'm interested that you say that Princeton is one of the more centrist. Which of the Ivy League universities in America is the most left, according to your experiences and the things you've read?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, in some sense, Brown is the most left because they, for decades now, have abandoned grades.
Right.
So they don't believe in ranking people because that stokes inequality. So you just get a note from your professor to say you were really good. That's nice.
It's like those participation trophies that they give out.
Exactly.
Yes.
But Yale and Harvard, I think, have got some of the more virulent, strong left voices. But I should just also add that Princeton has undergone this crazy thing where it's certainly lurched, I think, under its current president Eisenberger to the left. Mm-hmm. It took down Woodrow Wilson's name from the university after a long debate about that a few years ago. It is got professors who demanding that there is a student body of only black students that vet all future publications, which I think is really crazy. And its publications, the Princeton Alumni Weekly and the Princeton Daily News, are I think making a lot of noise and not shedding a lot of light right now, which is unfortunate because it really is a great institution, and I'm super excited about the fact, for example, that Princeton has reignited its plasma research for nuclear fusion, which is exciting potential technological development in the next decade.
I mean, can you imagine if we develop a fusion reactor of a particular size, and that, you know, that there is some speculation that they could make these devices if they can manage to contain it, you could make it the size of a suitcase effectively. Now imagine, and it could put out terabytes of energy, terawatts of energy, and that would solve the problem for so many governments. At the same time, we'd be able to do things in an environmentally friendly way. There'd be an oversupply for the first time in the history of the world of energy. And it would revolutionize things in untold ways. So good luck to Princeton on that front. But if I can, let's just quickly go back to the Nobel Peace Prize for a minute, because it's such a controversial thing, and it never was. You know, the Nobel Peace Prize, when it was given to people like Nelson Mandela, Chief Albert Luthuli, F.W. de Klerk, Desmond Tutu, it was something that was kind of a recognition for people who were in tough places at tough times, doing the right thing. Although she's become a much more controversial figure since, Aung San Suu Kyi, There have been people in Hong Kong who I think are probably deserving of this at this stage because they're facing unbelievable odds in the countries in which they live. And they're standing up for principle, for human rights, for decency, for free speech. And probably Hong Kong is at the top of my list. Do you guys, can you think of anybody in the last 12 months who you think deserves the Nobel Peace Prize?
I've got to say Trump deserves it.
Yeah, but you would say that just to watch leftist heads explode.
Well, no, I'm actually saying it on the basis of what's happened in the past couple of weeks, specifically with regard, first
the
and foremost,
UAE and Israel,
to the UAE and Israel, that rapprochement. And then the second thing that's happened is the entire thing that he's brokered in terms of the Balkans.
Where,
I
think part of the it's not a bad line.
That has to do with what, Serbia and Kosovo and the normalization of relations there. Yeah.
Yes. Well, but normalization is kind of a loaded scenario. Gabriel, I don't know if you've been following this, but effectively, he's theoretically brokered a deal, but neither party has signed the same deal. So each party has signed their own deal with the U.S. government. Hmm. And effectively, the deal as it stands right now is that Serbia promises to not to recognize Kosovo, but not to stop other people from recognizing Kosovo over the course of the next year. And in fact, there was this video clip doing the rounds when Trump announced that Serbia was going to move its embassy out to Jerusalem. Mm. And the president of Serbia was kind of looking around. Did I agree to that? What? And he starts rough, going through his notes. Wait a second. So yeah, that's already been me.
Yeah,
but having said that, you know, I think that this is, they're all dog faces in that part of the world. But I think anything that actually takes them a step closer to actually not wanting to kill each other all the time is probably a good thing.
Right. Yeah. I second that. I think that the former Soviet bloc is really a mess. And the ongoing war in the Donbass and Ukraine is kind of crazy, sort of ground to a halt, but theoretically still going. I think part of Trump's problem is that when he first became president, he talked up a peace deal or the nuclear disarmament with North Korea. And the first time that people were talking about him getting the Nobel Peace Prize, it was because of the thought that if he managed to convince the Kims to disarm their nuclear arsenal, then that really would be one of the greatest achievements in peace in the 21st century. And then that kind of didn't play out the way that it had been hoped. I think among South Koreans who were huge Trump fans and huge America fans at the time, and I think many still are, but I think having set the bar so high for himself and in so many people's minds, it'll be a tricky sell. If he wins re-election and he manages to create further rapprochement in the Middle East.
I hear some doubt at the idea that he might win the election there, Gabriel?
Yeah, no, I think it's 50-50.
Can I just add briefly that one of the things that he's done, which seems to me to be quite important, and it's a point made by Ben Shapiro, that the interesting take Trump has had on this, which is different to those of the take of his predecessors, is that he's making the chief discussion between Israel and the other Arab countries, not putting the Palestinians in as the major negotiators on the one part, because obviously Palestinians have only really been a state in inverted commas since 1967. Some parts of the world acknowledge that they're a terrorist organization, the PLO. And by making a bunch of disgruntled people who used to actually be part of the possessions of both Egypt and Jordan, the main interlocutors, you create a really twisted scenario where their grievances become the central point in any discussion. He's now almost gone past the angels directly to God and is working out relationships with Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, whatever Syria is at the moment, and leaving Iran, who've been the chief fomenter of trouble in that area, out of the discussion completely. We know how they've used Hezbollah. both in Yemen and in Lebanon and in other places to cause huge amounts of trouble and imbalance, which has upset the Sunnis in the area. And now he's drawing the Sunnis closer to him. This discussion with the UAE and Israel is obviously a good one. And I think it's probably going to lead to a much more stable long-term peace.
Yes, but let's not forget that that ISIS are also Sunnis.
Yes, that's also true. No, look, there's no easy way. But if the Middle East, if the Middle East can be more peaceful by the day than it was yesterday, then we're making progress of a kind.
Yeah, let's not underestimate the significance of the Saudis agreeing that El Al flights can overfly Saudi Arabia to get to the UAE.
Big deal.
Yeah, absolutely huge.
All right, so let's come back to South Africa because this is our area of chief concern and there's much to discuss. It's never a dull day in South Africa. So let's just talk quickly about what's been going on. Obviously, I think you guys would be joining me in our commiserations with the Bezos family. George Bezos really was an incredible legal mind, and he was someone who was an important and integral part of our history, having defended Nelson Mandela at the Rivonia trials. And George Bezos continued to make a massive contribution to the law, helped in drafting our constitution. Do you want to add anything to that, Canthan, Gabriel?
Yeah. If I could just say, I think it was last year, I went to almost a living funeral, in the sense that Bezos was very much there. Yeah. But I think people were very aware that he's very elderly. Yeah. At the Apartheid Museum, where they have a new wing in his name that was basically being officially opened, the George Bezos wing of the Apartheid Museum. And it's an art space. So a lot of the museum is very well curated, but it's historical museum stuff, archival footage and such. And this museum is a sort of living space for new exhibitions. And I think that the sort of outpouring of respect and love for him that I saw there was remarkable. And that venue itself is a great tribute to him. And I think Christopher Till, who runs the Apartheid Museum, does a really good job of finding sparkling, provocative, interesting South African artists to put there. So once people have a chance to go out, I'd recommend if you want to feel like paying a bit of a tribute to George Bezos, go check out the George Bezos Museum.
Excellent, excellent point.
Yeah, I've met him a few times. And again, you know, what always struck me in conversations with him, there was this kind of almost Einsteinian air about him. There was a sort of piercing wisdom in terms of how he would utter a few words, but he would make those words count. And witty, extremely witty, yes.
Yeah, I do feel like we've lost a piece of our collective brain with his passing. But as you say, he was an older man, and obviously we can't have regret if someone manages to have as full a life as he has and a life of such contribution and die in your 90s. I think you can consider yourself quite fortunate for that.
Yeah, and if I can just say one more thing, I mean, it's also helpful to just remember where he began. Mm. I mean, his life story in some way starts on a boat off the coast of Greece with his father running away from the Nazis. And I think that awareness of, that trauma really informed a lot of his life, a lot of his willingness to speak out against power.
And he did truly brave things, and he faced truly evil adversaries. Now, this leads me into something I've wanted to discuss for a long time, and you guys make the perfect panel for us to talk about this. I believe we have something in South Africa called struggle envy, and it may also be something which I see in America. And you can tie together the pieces as you wish. But I think we have a country at the moment where there are obviously serious problems. A lot of those problems stem from maladministration and corruption. A lot of those problems stem from the usual growing pains of a democracy. And we're still young by international standards, and we still have much ground to cover. But when I see the kinds of things that we've seen in the last while, where there are manufactured crises in the body politic that have to do with either a shampoo, and by no means do I wish to make fun of or mock the real pain that some people feel, because some people have had trauma in their lives of various kinds, and this is a trigger for that trauma to be realized. But when I watch the EFF, for example, or I see the response to the DA's latest policy decisions, a lot of this response seems to me to be grounded in some kind of struggle envy. You know, when George Bezos was fleeing actual Nazis, or when he was standing up in front of the apartheid government bench arguing for Nelson Mandela's being released from a death sentence and put into life sentence instead, these were proper fights that had proper consequences in history. And I feel that there are a lot of people who, maybe it's just, you know, that old adage of, if you're not young and a liberal, you don't have a heart. If you're not old and conservative, you don't have a brain. But I look around and I see a lot of young people who are struggling to find a thing to be seen to care about. They're almost looking for a reason for their peers to respect them. There aren't any issues, because most people have grown up in the last 30 years of human history. There's been a lot of softness, and there's been a lot of luxury, and there's been a lot of improvement in the human condition, something which Marion Tupi makes a very good point about every day on humanprogress.org. We're in a good place as humanity. And now, this year, for the first time in a long time, we've had an actual crisis to deal with, and we've been found quite wanting. Do you believe that there is such a thing as struggle envy, and that when we see the EFF protesting outside of cliques, they're really doing a pantomime of what their fathers and mothers did during apartheid, fighting a real enemy? And they're tilting at windmills.
Yeah, I think let's not confuse what the EFF is doing with the core of the stuff you're speaking about, Gareth, because I think that you are quite right. There is a need for every generation to essentially find a cause to nail their colors to. And I think over the years, generally, there have been real things that people have been able to find. What has happened is that we've now reached a stage where that tendency has effectively been weaponized by specific groups of people. So, for example, I've always considered myself an environmentalist, because I do care about things like pollution. I do care about things like acid rain. I do care about things like deforestation. Mm-hmm. But do I believe in the weaponization of climate change, where suddenly carbon dioxide becomes the issue and it effectively becomes a way for states to end up taxing the masses? No. But again, this is one of those things that has ended up being weaponized. Now, you take the case of Black Lives Matter, for example. You know, is there a need for us to be concerned about inner city degradation and this ongoing spiral that keeps people in those urban sprawls effectively trapped into a cycle of drugs and violence? Yes, we should. But again, it's now been weaponized by a particular group. And that's exactly what the EFF has ended up doing in this country. So I think the question really is how to refocus those efforts into things that people can actually adopt and make their own in a way that's not going to be able to be hijacked by the likes of organizations like the EFF, or organizations like Black Lives Matter, or organizations like Greta Thunberg Incorporated. And that really is the issue. But now, you know, interestingly, I just want to touch on something else. You know, Steve Biko's death anniversary is coming up again in a couple of days' time, the 12th of September. And, you know, historically, well, for the longest time, I've always attended the annual Biko lecture. And this year, I have no idea what the Steve Biko Foundation is actually thinking, but they've got Al Sharpton invited to deliver the Biko lecture. And I cannot for the life of me think of how on earth they could draw a correlation between the type of stuff that Steve Biko and so many of his friends at the time were trying to do, and the type of invective that gets spewed out by the likes of Al Sharpton. And this is the problem with when you have these institutions that then lose touch with what their original intent was. The Nelson Mandela Foundation has gone down a very similar track.
Yeah, but this is what I'm talking about. This is exactly what I mean, is that we seem to be tilting at windmills. The real evil people are so hard to identify in a time of plenty, and really for the last couple of years we have been in a time of plenty, certainly There haven't been any obvious ideological enemies for people who are good and who view themselves as good to be fighting against. And that links to the discussion around the Nobel Peace Prize we were just having. My point is that this wokeism, critical race theory, identitarian politics, social justice, all of these things seem to me to be almost manufactured in order to give a home to people who know that they need to have a cause. They need to have a purpose in their lives. And for many of these people, the intention is pure. It's good. It comes from a good place. But they've been fed nonsense. And the things they're fighting are not corporeal. They're not real. My point is being made by examples like, you know, you see, for example, I mean, if you were fighting actual Nazis on the beaches of Normandy, or if you were fighting in the struggle against apartheid, or if you were fighting communism in the 1980s, or if you were fighting against capitalism then, those were real battles with actual consequences. Now we see people taking on these causes because the cost is very low, and they can claim virtue points for victories that aren't even victories, when a lot of these things are not substantial. You know, if you talk about systemic racism, you have to be able to identify the policy or the person who's creating those things. And none of the people who are complaining about those things can identify those two problems. They can't tell me which law is racist. They can't show me which person. And when they do find someone who behaves stupidly because they're just an adult who has racist ideas, that person is not indicative of a system. They're usually an outlier. So the enemy is not clear. And I think that that's a massive danger, because what it does is it just disrupts and ruptures society.
Gareth, you've actually nailed it. The specific issue that they've got right now is that there's no end game. You know, climate change, for example, when does it actually end? It's not that we have a specific thing that says we are going to shut down this particular plant that is spewing carbon dioxide into the
air. I just want to add one last point to it, and then I promise you it's yours. But there isn't a solutions-focused pathway here either. It's all about the problem. People are constantly bringing up their problems, but they're not actually willing to. They don't want to hear about solutions, because if there's a solution, their problem goes away. And their problem, the grievance, is actually the point.
And the entire industry collapses. That's exactly right.
And that's what Al Sharpton does. That's what all of these people do for a living.
So I think in terms of generations climbing up, one of the things about people in their 20s is that you get out of the situation where you've been taken care of by your parents, your material needs, and so far as, you know, they get met, you get educated as well as you do. And then you need to break out into the world and find a way to add value. If you're in a sort of well-organized society, you find a job where you're doing well, or you write, or you become an entrepreneur, or something like that. And I do think that one of the crises South Africa faces is youth unemployment, which has been shocking over the last decade in particular, as well as low skills. And so I think that creates a base of potentially very angry people. And one of the troubles is, I think here and in America, that if you don't see a way to find dignity through work, then one of the things that's quite tempting is to think that work itself, or the idea itself of the work ethic, is the problem. And that becomes the enemy. And then industry becomes the enemy, and then you use the green agenda to be sort of all for ending all industry. Or you use some idea of white monopoly capital to go after South Africa's economy. And one of the ironic things I figured out recently is, like, StatsSA has this data which wasn't very well covered, which shows that which they published last year, which shows that since 2015, black South Africans have earned the majority of income, of national income. White South Africans earned about 30%. If you look at the top, the biggest slice of income, a quarter has gone to the top 10% of black earners. The top 10% of white earners are ranked fourth. They only get 10% of income. So, I mean, white monopoly capital is a really weird thing to go after when the top 10% of white people are only earning 10% of national income, and the top 10% of black people are earning 25% of national income. So that's to say, I think South Africa has very real problems. I think it's been a time for plenty for those of us lucky enough to have found ways of adding value and getting paid for it. But for the majority of South Africans, there was like great upliftment through the 2000s and then a stalling in growth and a stalling in new opportunities. And at the very same time, you had politicians in particular who used a scapegoat, you know, punch white ghosts in the face, go after this figment to distract from their own maladministration. And one of the things that I think is important to note here is the role of mainstream editors, mainstream journalists. And yeah, I've got one particular bug to pick on this week, which is Adrian Besson's response to the DA's new non-racial policy. So he runs the most widely read news publication in the country. The DA, for the first time in a decade at least, adopts a non-racial policy. Why? As Ivan Mayer, the Western Cape Finance MEC, said, we want redress for poor people, not for the elites. That is the DA's economic justice policy in a sentence. And it couldn't be simpler. No more fabulous tenders for Nomvula Mokonyana's daughter. Esma Khashule's kids don't get counted as previously disadvantaged.
Okay, so just quickly, to make sure that we're all on the same page here, I don't really read Adrian Besson anymore. I've given up on that. But what did he say? What was his criticism of the DA's new policy?
He said this is basically white people going after black people. Black leaders in the DA are under pressure. They can't possibly stand up for this. And if the DA keeps going down this line, they're going to shrink to 10% of the vote because all of their black voters and all of their black leaders are going to flee. And it's just crazy. He won't mention Gwen Nguyen's name. She is the head of policy at the DA. She has drafted this policy. She has put her career on the line because in 2019, when she wanted to raise a debate about BEE, Musi Maimane wouldn't let it happen, so she resigned. He was then quoted as saying, shut up, when people wanted to debate BEE. Hmm. And then, you know, she was going to give up on politics forever. And then she got a chance to get back in the party. She's drafted this policy. The party has nominally accepted the policy, adopted it. It's got widespread support from a party that is the most diverse, racially speaking, party in the country. And, you know, I was just reading an article now by, let me just remember his name, Bongikosi Madikizela. You've got Ian Mayer, you've got Mcheka, the deputy federal chairperson, all endorsing this. But Adrian Besson won't mention that because it doesn't suit his narrative. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because it's exactly what you were saying. I think a lot of our journalists have struggle envy. Mm. I think Besson looks at a person like Helen Ziller, Alistair Sparks, whoever, the great heroes, everyone who worked at Drum, of the apartheid regime, journalists who were going into Soweto when it was not only being, you know, there weren't just tires on fire, there were people being shot. You know, there were 25,000 people being killed between 86 and 94 in the People's War. And journalists went in there to cover that. And they were being raided by the police. Rand Daily Mail was raided, and George Bezos was sometimes their lawyer, on an almost weekly basis when they were busting the Muldergate scandal. There was very serious repression, very serious resistance. And I think a lot of journalists today sort of wish that they could be that cool, that they could be that fated to face a regime that's willing to come and steal their goods and lock up their sources and lock them up. And that's just not on the card. As nasty as the government is, it hasn't put any editors behind bars or anything like that. Mm-mm. But I think because of that envy, that struggle envy, they're fighting the same ideological battle of the 1980s in the 2020s. They still sort of see this like white versus black, white monopoly capital idea as being the predominant issue to challenge. And so
one almost gets the feeling that they haven't read a good article on the position against them.
Yeah.
Which is frightening. I mean, so what do you want to say to that, Canton?
Well, it's difficult to find a media house that's not compromised in some way. So that really is the starting point, because everyone, to some extent, is part of the ANC's inner circle at some level, with the possible exception of of the Daily Maverick. But apart from that, if you consider Naspers has ANC people setting up in their upper echelons, Times Media, or whatever they call themselves now. They were Times Media, then they were VUSA. Then
Arena now.
Okay, yes. And then, of course, there's independent newspapers, all of these guys. But at the same time, you have to also take the view that there's been a corresponding massive decline in terms of their influence upon the body politic in this country. People just don't take them seriously anymore. People don't bother reading opinion pieces anymore. Now that you have the ability to disseminate...
I mean, here's an example. An example of this, precisely what you're talking about. So Carol Payton wrote for the Business Day, DA now a party for some, not all, as the new race policy entrenches denialism. I mean, we should be glad at this point that people are even reading policy, because up to now they haven't. But Carol Payton wrote that, and Brett Dawson, who's the former boss of Dimension Data, said, oh, for goodness sake, it's time for SA to move on to opportunity for all, which I think is indicative of a lot of the attitudes of people who are just tired of this ideological backward nonsense when we actually have proper issues to deal with. We have seriously, we have people who are being left behind in every way. And most of those people are not being looked after by the media in general. They're not being catered to by the media. The media are in a clickbait battle with each other. And they're also trying to inveigle their way into the corridors of power so that they can get the exclusives that they need to keep the clicks going. And I think people like Brett Dawson are actually pointing out something a lot of us are feeling, that all of this opinionated nonsense from the supposed intelligentsia is actually driving people away from it, which is why people are not subscribing to Adrian Basson's publication.
Well, Business Day is purportedly a business publication, but do they have rich journalists? Now, if you have people working for these publications who are trying to tell us how to run the economy and themselves don't have a clue how to manage their own money and become wealthy in the process, why do we take them seriously at any level?
Yeah.
Now, look, I'm far more likely to take the word of someone like Alec Hogg, who actually engages actively in things like investment funds. He actually talks investment strategy. He talks in terms of the things that he ends up putting his own money into. Mm-hmm. And he has managed to set up his own business and run it very successfully. Well, twice, in fact, because remember, he founded MoneyWeb, which was very successful. He lost MoneyWeb because of a messy divorce. Because basically, no, it's true. Because effectively, his ex-wife's share then got bought out by Caxton, and he effectively lost control of the business. But he clawed himself out of that and has built up BizNews into something that, look, I frequently did.
Are you saying?
But my point is,
are you saying don't read
Carol Payton?
Yeah, don't read what losers are writing.
Yeah. Exactly. Don't read what.
Yeah. I want to second that. It's just my job to do it, to try and keep track. And I think one of the unfortunate things is that we have run out of time. And that it would be nice. One of the crazy things about our politics is the disconnect between sort of the grassroots feeling as we pick up on our statistical surveys and what goes on in the media bubble. And the sort of pragmatism of so many ordinary South Africans really needs to filter through to policy decisions post haste. I think one of the key things to quickly point out is that there was this very crazy story where Trevor Manuel said in a conference. Now, Trevor Manuel is another person to really take seriously. He said, you know, we've had 30 wasted years. And then this was reported on. And then he said, oh, no, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to say 30 wasted years. I meant to say 10 wasted years. In fact, first he said, I didn't say 30 wasted years. And Fin24 must retract that. And then they published the video of him saying 30 wasted years. And then he sort of, he quiets it down a little bit. But the point is, there was widespread coverage in Business Day and the other major networks you guys have been talking about, and no one entertained the thought that maybe we have wasted 30 years, in the sense that 94 to 2007, huge progress, both in rights and in material outcomes. But since 2013, our GDP per capita in inflation-adjusted terms has been going downwards from 2013. Hmm. And if you look at that peak, a very serious question to ask is, when are we even going to return to that? And I don't think it'll happen. You know, it's not going to happen overnight. Even if you did adopt a pragmatic policy, it would take, by the estimations of my colleagues, John Endres, at least 7 years to get up to around 7% GDP growth. And you'd need quite a few years of that to get back to that peak, especially given the situation we're in now. So it could be that it takes us like 20 or 30 years to get back to where we were in 2010.
I'm delighted, obviously, to have two people who we can talk about the macro and the philosophical stuff with. But there are a couple of practical things that I'd like to hear your comments on too, gentlemen. First one is Port Elizabeth, and this has hardly been spoken about. Port Elizabeth, which is one of the major metros in South Africa, which I didn't think was being run into the ground, but clearly it is, has got no water at the moment. There is no water for the people of PE. There are people who have to line up, and not just people in informal settlements where they don't have proper adequate water supply or plumbing or any of that stuff. People in all suburbs of PE are lining up at water bowsers to collect buckets of water in order to use for their cooking and their cleaning and their lavatories and all the rest of it. This is happening in a major metropolitan area in South Africa, and hardly anyone is talking about it. It is a disgrace that the people of PE have reached day zero. Remember all the noise about Cape Town and day zero? People at least were invested in Cape Town. No one seems to care about PE. What's going on?
Yeah, this sort of reminded me, I haven't been able to figure out, as it were, who to blame. Although it doesn't seem like maintenance was kept up in the way that it should have been.
I know who to blame immediately, and I will tell you. The person you blame is Bantu Holomisa, because he is the person who handed control of the city back to the African National Congress just at the point at which that very fragile DA coalition was about to actually turn the city around.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I just wanted to say, when I came across the story,
I've got Bantu Holomisa on the line. Hang on.
I blame God. I blame God.
Me of Angus clip there.
Sorry, we were all. Someone was delayed, and the joke fell flat. So let's carry on.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
No.
So I just want to say, I want to try and give people a small grain, smattering of hope here. So last year, I think it was, I went down to the Southern Free State and Northern KZN to follow up on some farm attack stories and speak to people all there. And on the way, I decided to pull in for dinner with a friend of mine in Harrismith. And he's a farmer. He's also an investment banker. He said, come along by godfather to my niece. And he said, I'm just a bit busy right now. Could you come find me on the side of the highway? So I did. And what he was doing was personally fixing the pipes running from, some of the largest dams in the country to Harrismith. And the reason for this was that Harrismith had had low water pressure for about 6 years and had exactly no water whatsoever for 6 weeks. Some places 8 weeks that were lower down, higher up on the water table. So for 2 months, Harrismith had no water, and it wasn't a story covered anywhere. And he said, he's got a thick Afrikaans accent. He said, Gabriel, I just wanted to water my plants. So I decided to go and fix the pipe myself. And that kind of can-do spirit was amazing. But he thought about it seriously. He went to go and fix the pipes, and the municipality got in the way, and they said, no, you can't do this. This is like our competency. And he said, what competency are you talking about? And so he realized he was going to need a little bit of help. Mm-hmm. So he went to some of the local gangsters. And he said to those guys, how do you feel about the situation? And they said, we feel extremely irritated. And they talked about it, and they talked about it. And they got to the point where they were explaining, our own gorgors cannot wash themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, gangsters were getting to the point where they were harassing. They were getting their sort of lieutenants to get young people to go walk kilometers to go and fetch buckets of water so that their gorgors could wash themselves, as if this was 40 years ago. And they said, enough is enough. If you can tell us how to fix this problem, we'll fix this problem. So he said, come along with me. We'll go to fix the pipes. And if anyone comes along there to interrupt us, you just have a polite word with them.
Right.
And it totally worked. The municipality suddenly became very, very enthusiastic about this project. After they'd spoken to some of the taxi bosses and gangsters, they said, no, this is fantastic. Please fix this. This is going to be great. And then there was a sort of a huge transformer that had been stolen, and one of the farmers in the region spent 2.5 million rand to buy the new transformer because there'd been a delay in getting the order through so that part of the town could get electricity back again. And then sort of ex post sue the government to try and get refunded, which I'm not sure where that is. But I think this is to speak to a scenario that Franz Krenier, the CEO of the Institute of Race Relations, often talks about, which is the sort of enclave scenario where South Africa, where the union buildings effectively becomes an institution whose major competency is watering the gardens of the union buildings. And everywhere else in South Africa, you make your own plan. Private security, you reticulate your own water, you get your own power generation going. And it's a little bit anarchic. I think our libertarian friends will be enthused by it. I mean, obviously there's challenges to it, but, you know, like it or loathe it, I think that it is increasingly a situation to adapt to.
All right. So, Canton, you said that this is Bantu Holomisa's fault. I like a short, sharp answer, but I also think that Gabriel's illustrating precisely the point that many of us have to deal with in this country.
And well, but Port Elizabeth specifically, Gareth, you know, just to get the kind of frivolous comment. I mean, the Bantu Holomisa comment is absolutely correct. But the issue really in terms of Nelson Mandela Bay is that they've run out of HTH, very simply. Because effectively, in order to have drinking water that's not going to have E. coli and all of the other stuff that's going to kill you very quickly, you need to be chlorinating the water. And the contracts for providing the chemicals that are required to actually treat the water in the dams. So it's not that there's no water in the taps. Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, the water in the taps is dangerous.
Well, there is also zero water in the dams. Some of them have not been maintained, and some of the water infrastructure has not been looked after properly. But there's also the question of, you know, God hasn't sent them any rain, so he's also partly to blame. I wasn't being entirely glib when I said that. Now, we obviously know that. We know the scenario.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure she means well.
We know the scenario around power, and we were joking on the show this morning that more and more people are starting to think of battery and inverter systems for home so that they can just keep the lights on effectively and work from home, which many of us have been conditioned to do for the last while. So again, this plays into Gabriel's argument that we need to all be self-sufficient, and government almost becomes something which you just pay to shut up and get out of the way.
Let me touch on something that actually goes to the starting point of our conversation, which was when we were talking about the Ivy League universities. Mm-hmm. Now, Gabriel's a bit too young to remember this, but when I was a freshman at Princeton in the 80s, there was something going at the time on the campus that was called the Endowment for Divestiture. Mm-hmm. And effectively, you understand that Princeton University's endowment is massive. You know, it runs into tens of billions.
It was 13 billion when I started, and then through the global financial crisis, they added another 20 percentage points in 2 years.
Absolutely right. Now, but at the time, in the 80s, there was something like, I think about 10% of the endowment was either directly or indirectly invested in American businesses that were doing business in South Africa. And so students at Princeton set up this thing called the Endowment for Divestiture, which is basically telling people who would normally give money to the university. By the way, I give money to Princeton every year when annual giving comes around. But they said basically, do not give your money directly to Princeton. Stick your money into this escrow account. And the point at which Princeton then pulls out from all of its South Africa-related investments, will then release this money back into the Princeton endowment. And of course, it turned out that eventually both houses of Congress overruled the president and passed sanctions against South Africa, and so this kind of became a moot point. But the reason why I'm touching on this is one of the things that we had come up with as one of the Capitalist Party platforms was the idea of setting up of individual communities setting up these escrow accounts where residents pay their rates not into the municipality, but pay it into the escrow account. The escrow account then uses the money first and foremost to fix issues in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. and then pays the balance over to the municipality, and then you fight it out in the courts. And the whole idea is that in that way, you're actually ensuring that first and foremost, your community at an organized level. And I think effectively that's what's happened in Harrismith, Gabriel. Mm-hmm. We've had a scenario where basically the municipality has been told, well, actually, you're not getting the money. The money is getting paid to us, and we're putting it to real work, and there's transparency, complete accountability. Everyone knows exactly where their money is being spent, and everyone gets it. And essentially, the only thing that stands in the way of us being able to do that right now are the courts. And, you know, again, this is something that I touched on last week, Gareth, where I said that in as much as the courts come down in favor of us on very specific points of principle, overall, the courts are buying into the idea of the National Democratic Revolution. So you've had this decision in terms of the squatters in the Western Cape, which, you know, effectively riding roughshod over property rights in the interests of touchy-feely bullshit.
Yeah. And, yeah, you can't evict someone even if they're not living there. You just put your stuff in someone else's property and you're not allowed to remove it.
If someone moves into my spare room, I can't eject them?
No, you literally can't. As long as lockdown, as long as we remain under the state of emergency, that ruling nominally remains in place. I mean, yeah, it really is. And if you look at the number of land invasions that have taken place in the Western Cape and around the country in the last few months, it's exactly what you'd expect with a combination of a court ruling like that, a media that's totally sympathetic to people who take stuff, and politicians who say, go and take the land, it's yours.
Speaking of criminals, because that's what they are, I'm going to quickly just, as a last thought, ask you to maybe give a response to this. We've sent Ace Magashule, Lindiwe Zulu, Nomvula Mokonyane. I know this sounds like a joke, but we've sent these people on a plane to Zimbabwe this week to...
And they crept back with the tails between their legs.
Well, I mean, first of all, congratulations to our government for finally putting a whole lot of criminals on a Conair flight. But the problem was that we didn't have Nicolas Cage on there to take them all out. So they all came back with their tails between their legs. Any comments on the success or failure of Cyril's brilliant idea to send these particular
people? They didn't
speak
to the opposition.
Yeah, they just met with ZANU-PF.
So this was effectively an ANC delegation meeting the ZANU-PF delegation. What we should have had is a South African delegation meeting a Zimbabwean delegation.
Yes.
At an official level.
Right. But no, this is how the ANC thinks.
But again, it's this entire notion that, well, Cyril is not able to separate the party from the country. Mm. And that has always been the issue with the African National Congress. They're not able to draw that separation.
So in some of the consultations I've had with major European and North American diplomats, I've tried to get them to think of this analogy of Pretoria and Tehran. So as we were saying earlier in the show, part of the problem in the Middle East is that Tehran it foments destability. And I think South Africa, I mean, we're in a very strong position in the SADC region. We've got by far the most sophisticated economy. We should have by far the most sophisticated military, rule of law, law and order. We should be the standard bearers, and we should be really capable of assisting our neighbors in becoming more stable and responsible and consensual governments. And I think that we really have done the opposite. And and in some ways it does start in 2000 when the land invasions occur in Zimbabwe and Thabo Mbeki decides to take a quiet diplomacy approach. You might say his hands were tied by the African National Congress's internal dynamics, but It's both the way that we behave at a formal diplomatic level, as well as the example that we set with the ANC pursuing explicitly a national democratic revolution. you know, the message we're sending to our neighbors is that if you want to get ahead, be like us, the richest economy in the region, in overall terms, then law and order, don't worry about that. Just stand by and watch as people burn what assets they do have to the ground. And I think this is a vignette of that larger theme of South Africa sowing greatest destability. And I think if the ANC stays in charge for the next 2 decades, the resources that it's going to have to deploy, particularly if you have someone like David Mabuza take over, in order to maintain authority in a country that is just a total wreck in terms of employment, disgruntlement, 10 violent protests a day. Mm-hmm. I think we could have an authoritarian lurch, and if we do that, become instead of sort of passive, proactive aids to authoritarians on our borders.
All right.
Just a couple of things I want to touch on very quickly because we're about to run out of time. Mm-hmm. The one is, which ties in with what you were saying just now, Gabriel, the point at which Julius Malema is able to pull out a weapon on stage, fire it into the air, and police are still investigating years later. And yet you have a woman who brandishes a weapon, clearly in self-defense, does not actually fire it, and ends up getting arrested. And the entire premise around, and remember that shots were fired at Nasrec as well. Hmm. And again, video evidence that actually nails down the people who were specifically committing those acts, police are still investigating. But as soon as you have soft targets, they will actually act upon it. So people get arrested. 300,000 people arrested in the course of the lockdown. Is that figure this cuts to the chase in terms of the fact that this government is only prepared to act against the defenseless not against those who are actually in need of being defended. So I think let's kind of keep that perspective going forward. But ultimately, what's going to need to happen is that people need to recognize that when the mobs come to your door, you cannot rely on this government to protect you.
Yeah.
And start planning for that right now.
All right. Well, what a positive, optimistic thing to leave the burning platform on this morning. Thanks so much, Canton. If you were hoping for a lift, if you were hoping for some sugar-coated lift this morning, that's not what you're going to get from Canton.
Oh, okay. Just on the question of a lift, by the way, I'm about to tweet something. Again, on Saturday afternoon, just before the formal BECO lecture, there's an informal BECO lecture by the 70s group, which I'm part of. And they'll be talking about lessons from Steve Biko. And so it's going to be Facebook live streamed, and I do invite people to.
Now, why would I want to listen to that when I could go listen to Al Sharpton talk about how everything is systemically racist and we can never beat the demons that are deep within us, vested in our most ancient history at a time when we were trying to find a constitution among a group of slave-owning white men?
Good Lord. Amen. Hallelujah.
All right, thank you, gents. Very nice.
That is that was brilliant.
Yes, go on.
Check out Big Daddy Liberty, my colleague Sihle Ngubesi's latest clip. We went down to Newcastle over the weekend for farm murder protest. Vida and Gent Rafferty were killed last Sunday. It's a tragedy, but the way that community got together to peacefully demonstrate and call for something more, and the interviews that Sihle does there it's heartbreaking, but it's also seriously good stuff. I mean, there's seriously good people out there that want what's right and are willing to put their face in front of a camera and say so. And I think it's really worth a check.
Well, I'm very, very pleased.
Lifted my spirits. It made me remember. You brought that up. We're a good country.
Yeah, we are a good country, and there are lots of good people here. I mean, there are as many good stories. The only problem is that the media don't really focus on them as much as they do the bad ones. Thank you very much, Canton Pillay. Thank you, Gabriel Krauser. Thank you to you for joining us for The Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's every week right here on cliffcentral.com. Don't miss it next week. And if you did miss any of this, You can hear a repeat and you can get the podcast and listen to it at your leisure.
CliffCentral.com.